Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Rebecca Walker. Walker is an author, speaker, and teacher. She is the daughter of writer Alice Walker and attorney Mel Leventhal. Walker graduated from Yale University in 1992, and she has written extensively on race, gender politics, and the changing face of contemporary American feminism. She is the author of several books, including the bestseller Black, White, and Jewish, Autobiography of a Shifting Self, and Baby Love, Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence. Walker is also co-founder of the Third Wave Foundation, a feminist activist organization that works for gender, racial, economic, and social justice. I'm talking to Rebecca Walker by phone from her home in Hawaii. Rebecca Walker, thank you so much for joining me.
It's my pleasure. I'm thrilled to be here.
Oh, great. Now, in your 2001 autobiography, Black, White, and Jewish, you talk about the confusion of navigating different racial identities. Tell us a little bit about your parents and in those early years of discovering all these different selves that you had in you.
Well, I think as anyone who's read my book or knows my work knows already, I grew up as the daughter of an African-American novelist, Alice Walker, and my father is a Jewish white attorney from Brooklyn who does a lot of corporate litigation now but was a civil rights lawyer when my parents met. They met during the movement, both of them called by Dr. King down to Mississippi where I was born. And I had a really, as I write in Black, White, and Jewish, I had a very idyllic life while they were together, even though I think it was very tough for them being interracially married in a time when anti-miscegenation laws were still on the books. They were being run out of town constantly by white supremacists. The Klan left cards on our doorstep. But my family was together, and my identity was very coherent, cohesed, because it made sense, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on when they divorced, they moved to different parts of the country. My father moved back to New York and my mother moved 3,000 miles away to California. And they both pretty much returned to their kind of native cultures and communities. So my father settled in Westchester, you know, in a very Jewish sort of upper middle class, predominantly white community, and my mother into a kind of Afro-Bohemian, black and mixed San Francisco, more progressive, liberal community. And I moved back and forth, and it was very difficult. And so really the book and that part of my life was about shifting my sense of self and who I was and trying to adapt and putting on different masks of identity in order to fit in and speaking the language of whatever context I was in, changing my clothes, seeing myself differently, seeing the other as, you know, the place that I had just been, those people were now the other.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
I had to really adjust to sort of secure a place within the dominant community wherever I was.
Mm-hmm. And this, your parents got divorced when you were 8, so you were having to take these dual roles very young. You would spend 2 years in New York and then 2 years in San Francisco. That in itself must have been difficult.
It was very challenging. I mean, luckily, it was New York and San Francisco, two great cities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It wasn't, so I had a lot of exposure to wonderful things just because I was in those places. But yeah, it was not easy. I think as I am now an adult and raising a child, I have a better understanding of what kids need in terms of stability for their psychosocial and psychoemotional development. And when I look back on all of the shifts that I was making without a lot of support, there wasn't a therapist. My parents mm-hmm. had never done it before. Divorce was relatively new. I really understand the specific ways in which it was hard for me psychologically. There was a part of my identity that just couldn't gel, couldn't relax, couldn't. I didn't feel.
You probably never found real home, yeah.
Yeah. So that was very, very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Did your parents ever talk to you while they were together or afterwards about racism and anti-Semitism specifically?
Oh yeah. Are you
mm-hmm.
kidding? That was
mm-hmm.
that mm-hmm. dinner table discussion. I mean, my parents were, still are very politically involved. You know, my father does pro bono cases, you know, police brutality cases, age discrimination cases, race discrimination cases. My mom is extremely active in lots of different social movements.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we were, you know, we've been, I've been talking about racism and anti-Semitism and classism and, mm-hmm. you know, ableism and, Palestine and Israel and Cuba and you know, colonization and, you know,
yes,
from
yes
my
you
whole,
have
you know,
as an adult.
Born.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But in your book, you
for better or for worse.
Yeah, know? No, for better. In your book, you do talk a little bit like you were very isolated and didn't have that many tools to navigate some of the worlds that you were entering. So that's why I asked that question.
Mm.
In regard to when you were young, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You don't really, you know, you have this visceral experience of racism, you know, and anti-Semitism and sex, you know, whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you're 9, 10, 11, you can't really contextualize yourself within it and see that you are being, you know, the target or the victim of it. And then when you get to be a teenager and you can see it, it's so horrifying to you that you don't really want to face it. It doesn't necessarily help you at that age. It just, you know, because you're going through adolescent development, it's just more mortifying than clarifying, if
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm, that does make sense. Now, when you were in the 12th grade, you decided to change your name to Walker
mm-hmm.
and just use your mother's surname instead of your father's. Tell us a little bit about the thinking. Was that something that was rising up in you for a while? Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Definitely. I had wanted to change my name. I would say, I think I was 16 when I finally did it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I had felt when my father moved to Westchester that he really changed his life and his focus. And I started to feel less and less connected to his world and more connected to this, you know, my mother's sort of the black bohemian, more politically engaged
mm-hmm.
and left world.
Definitely feminist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, she identifies as womanist, so...
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are subtle differences there in the way that those are manifest. But, you know, and I definitely felt like, we had talked a lot over the years about the matrilineal connection and the problems with patriarchy. And so I felt this emotional connection, this racial connection. I wanted to make this statement, you know, to my father. And then I had the sort of political ideology to back me up. It felt very natural at that point, and my mother was thrilled, and we went down to the courthouse, and I think it was very, at that point, very bonding for us.
How did your father react?
He was very, very hurt. I mean, extremely hurt. But, you know, it's a real, my father, he's just a very, very good human being, and to his credit, you know, he was hurt, but he didn't really flinch, you know, in terms of our relationship. You know, he accepted it, and we moved on. And I think he understood on a certain level, but it was definitely a moment, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Can you identify a time at some point when you actually did integrate all of your identities, or is that still an ongoing process for you?
I think that by the time I got to college, I had more of a sense of, or I would say actually, I had to go through college. I find this often with multiracial people, especially in my generation. I think the younger people coming up have a very different experience. But in my life, often my romantic, slash sexual relationships were places that I felt accepted in a different kind of way that often was transracial or trans, you know, class or whatever it was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had this kind of basis through these loving relationships that I had, you know, fairly young. And I think that was very helpful. And then growing up and then being in college, I went to this, you know, sort of hyper-intellectual place where lots of young people of color were trying to find their identities, and mm-hmm. I did a film
you went
about,
to Yale, right?
Yeah, I went to Yale, and, mm-hmm. and you know, I did a film about, you know, racial identity at Yale, and I had lots of, you know, friends, and we were constantly talking about it. And so I think by the time I finished college, I had a real strong understanding of the benefits of adaptability. I mean, I had been able to deconstruct the idea of race, and I had begun to see that underneath these different masks that I was wearing in different contexts, there was a being that was transcendent of the masks. There was someone underneath that.
Mm.
And I started to really more identify with that person. And then, you know, after the book was published, you know, I had started doing a lot of speaking to colleges, you know, right when I came out of college, because I found it third wave and started talking about that. But when Black, White, and Jewish came out, I started talking a lot at schools, and I just noticed that I could speak all of the different languages of most of the people in the room.
Mm.
And I started to become more and more comfortable with that, you know, almost as if, you know, I speak 10 languages. I'm still me. I just speak a lot of different languages, as if I could travel the world and just talk to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I learned new things about some people in some groups, and I knew more about others, but fundamentally it started to become an issue of fluidity rather than brokenness.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't have to isolate any of yourselves.
No, not so much. Mm-hmm. No. And then I became much more comfortable speaking up to people that I thought were being exclusionary or hurtful, or I started to feel like I could defend any group,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm. As we all should, I think.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that really gave me that ability, because I don't feel singularly defined by any region or
mm-hmm.
race or.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's before we do run out of time, I do want to talk to you about this huge transition that you decided to when you decided to have a child. You even wrote a book about it called Baby Love: Choosing Motherhood After a lifetime of Ambivalence. Tell us about the ambivalence.
So, Baby Love is about, you know, just recognizing that I did grow up in a very feminist, womanist environment. I was a Ms. baby, you know, I spent many days at the Ms. magazine offices. Gloria Steinem was my godmother, et cetera, mm-hmm. and so forth. And so I grew up with a sense that, you know, one's professional career and the freedom for women to manifest destinies separate from having children was really an important goal and the focus of life, really. And that maternity was something that had really bogged women down, you know, because there wasn't choice and because for so many reasons women were forced to bear children, that,
mm-hmm.
that part of resistance to domination had to do with not having children and not romanticizing motherhood. And that was fine. It was very important for me to have that perspective. But also at the same time, I had a deep longing to have a child. And those two things kept bumping up against each other. I had this ideological, theoretical perspective, and at the same time I had this deep psycho-emotional longing. And so I just remained ambivalent for many years about having a child. And then finally I met someone who was completely unambivalent, and when I began talking to him about my longing, he was very affirming and kind of helped me get through my ambivalence. And obviously, I'm so glad he did, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, I fell in love with my son, and I loved, you know, the process, even though it was totally anxiety-ridden, and anyone who reads Baby Love will go on the day-by-day journey of my anxiety, but also, you know, the transformative aspect of my pregnancy, so.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Rebecca Walker. She's a writer, speaker, and educator. And we're talking about her book, Baby Love, at the moment, Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence. You mentioned that your mother had said that motherhood is a hindrance to freedom and creativity. But I heard you say in an interview that it has opened a bigger landscape for you. So talk to us about how it has done that.
Well, I think that something happens when you have a child. You know, for me, something happened
mm-hmm.
that instead of becoming smaller, I became much bigger. That the maturation process, you know, that switch from being all about yourself to recognizing that it's not all about you, and being connected to the future through this being, and having this profound responsibility, and feeling this overwhelming unconditional love, and feeling how hard it is to help shape a human being and mm-hmm. keep them happy. I mean, you know, all of that made my life bigger. I mean, I don't see how it couldn't. I mean, I feel inspired by him. I feel driven to be more responsible, mm-hmm. you know, to him, to my partner, to myself.
So it's probably opened up your spirit in some ways. Do you actually feel more compassion for what your mother went through, or are you doing things entirely opposite of what you experienced?
Well, again, you know, in Baby Love, I talk a lot about, you know, the struggle that my mom and I had, and she, you know, and I write in that book about, you know, she wrote and finally told me she no longer wanted to be my mother, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, I haven't spoken to her since my son was born, so...
Oh, you still haven't?
No. So I would say, on some level, I understand how hard it is to raise a child, and to try to do your work, and, you know, keep food on the table, and keep a roof over your head. I mean, I'm much more in touch with that, you know, than ever. But I can't quite get to the I'm no longer your mother statement. I mean, you know, when I look at Tenzin, my son, I don't know that there's anything he could do that would prompt me to write him a letter saying that I no longer wanted to be his mother, or that there would be any way that I would think that would be sane or rational or workable, you know.
It does sound it's drastic, isn't it? Yeah. Was she upset about you writing so honestly about your life, which also includes her?
Yeah, I think that was very hard. I mean, I think, you know, this breaking point was around Black, White, and Jewish, and her feeling of how she was, you know, portrayed in the book. You know, obviously I felt like I did everything I could to protect her and take care of her as I had done my whole life, but she felt differently. And I think writing memoir in general is just, it's a challenge. I just wrote a post on the Huffington Post new writer page, and the post today that's up is, you know, why write memoir when fiction is so much more respectable? And it's all about, you know, what you lose. You know, it's a tough balance between figuring out what you absolutely must write or you feel you'll go crazy, and how to maintain your loving relationships with all the people who helped create your life and were actually there sharing those moments.
Mm-hmm. Your memoir, I must say, is quite beautiful. It's very honest, and I can tell that you have inherited the poet in your mother.
That's lovely. Thank you. That's a big, you know.
It's true. It's a beautiful memoir. I hope people will read it. I know it came out a few years ago, but I'm sure we can find some new readers for it. Now talk to us about the fact that you also teach writing, help people to navigate their own skills as writers. Talk to us a little bit about the workshops you give.
Well, I do lots of speaking at colleges and corporate campuses about navigating multiple identities, and I also teach amazing workshops, and I teach them all over the world. In the last couple of years, I've taught in Thailand and Stockholm and Provence, and right now I'm doing a couple of workshops in Maui here in the States, so there's one coming up in December. And, you know, they're really intimate, you know, 12 people in a workshop, and I really help people excavate what their story is and help them find their voice and sort of take them through all of this, the core steps of what a memoir is, or the form, actually, the memoir form, sort of solidifying for them, you know, the understructure. So we look at voice, and we look at memory, and we look at structure, and we look at themes, and we look also at, you know, how memoir is being located in the marketplace now, because I think it's really always important to talk about the business mm-hmm. part of making a living as a writer. So,
wonderful. Do you give people tips on how to deal with the fact that real living people might end up in the memoir and some of the scary things that can happen.
Absolutely. One of the first things
that
I tell
people in
my classes, my workshops, is that, you know, your worst nightmare can come true. You know, your people are so afraid to write their story because they're afraid of what someone might think and what someone might do. And I always say, look, your worst nightmare could happen. So you have to be extremely brave and you have to be courageous and you have to feel this, you know, unbearable almost urgency to write this story. You know, you have to feel as if you don't write it, you know, your life will not be complete because the stakes are very high and you have to be willing to face those stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And they always look at me like, oh my God. And then, you know, and then some of them get writing and some of them don't. And the ones who don't always say, thank you so much because I would have spent so long trying to do this and now you've freed up my energy to go do something else.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones who do say, thank you so much, you've given me the courage to do what I have to do. So,
well, that's a gift in itself.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think it's one of the things I hear the most from participants is, and my consults, I do a lot of manuscript consulting and I just worked on Kim Chernin's new novel, and, you know, most of my writers say things like, you know, you've just saved me 5 years of trying to figure this out, or thank you so much because if we didn't work together, I mean, you know, you need someone who can give you...
your voice.
Yeah, and give you really, I'm pretty hardcore, you know, I give pretty hardcore feedback. I think because I've bared so much that I'm very clear when people are hiding, and I really try to help them come out because. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's the thread that's been coming through your life since the beginning, and that your incredible honesty.
I try every day.
To tell us about some of the. Can you tell us a little bit about some of the political topics that you're into at the moment?
Well, I'm always speaking about, you know, navigating multiple identities, what we talked about, and how that discussion is playing out, you know, on a global scale. I think Obama is, with all of his struggles right now, he's really embodying someone who is more comfortable speaking these multiple identities and trying to find a way to create a new sort of world politic that includes that kind of fluidity. So I talk a lot about that. I'm always interested in shifting masculinity and how old patterns of masculinity have kind of embedded within them a sense of top-down power and control, and newer models of identity, masculinity are different, you know, and it's important to support men as part of our work to support women in their attempts to change. I mean, obviously, I'm interested in healthcare, and I'm interested in domestic violence, and I'm interested in the environment. You know, right now in Maui, we don't even have a recycling program that's functional. Here on Maui. I mean, it's, you know, and women on the island, you know, there are no epidurals available, and the healthcare system, you know, while people do have healthcare, there's only one hospital, and, you know, doctors are leaving the island, and so it's really affecting poor populations in a very serious way. I'm very passionate about mental health, and I try to speak a lot about the importance of, you know, making sure that we destigmatize mental illness.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, on and on. I think I tend to work in a more, you know, personal, you know, one small community at a time way. I try to work through my writing and speaking and interviews. I after Third Wave,
Could you tell us about Third Wave?
Sure, yeah. When I graduated from college, there was a sense that young women were very disconnected and alienated from feminism. And, you know, the artist that I am, I tried to come up with a creative way to reengage, and that ended up being Third Wave, which was a direct action organization that tried to, well, we did, that mobilized young women and men from all over the country to do social change projects and work. And Third Wave has morphed into Third Wave Foundation, which now gives grants to projects and organizations that support young women and men and transgender people age 15 to 30. And so after I started that organization, you know, I was, I don't know, 21, 22, I really kind of figured out that, A, I didn't want to be a political figurehead because it didn't give me range in my views. Mm-hmm. There was a kind of status quo way of looking at the world, and I found it very limiting to kind of be a political ideologue. And I also realized I wasn't an administrator when I was trying to run an organization. Really, I'm an artist. You know, I can't get away from it. I have, you know, I have strong, you know, beliefs about certain things, but I'm very open too. So Third Wave is thriving now, and I'm really, really happy about that. And I think, you know, I had to get out of the way to let it thrive because mm-hmm. I was really trying to create such an open, dynamic organization that, you know, it was almost too open and dynamic.
Yeah, those things
know,
do eventually. Yeah, you eventually need some structure. Rebecca, we only have about a minute left. You Twitter. You have a website. Can you talk to us just a tiny bit about what you're Twittering about?
Oh goodness, I Twitter about everything. I tweet about everything. I mean, I sometimes live tweet Mad Men, one of my favorite shows. I love Twitter. It's a great way to be in touch with a lot of people, and mm-hmm. it's like being at a great party, you know, and for introverts like myself, it's
uh-huh. And
ideal.
What about your website? Can you give them your website?
Sure. My website is RebeccaWalker.com, and my Twitter handle is just Twitter.com/RebeccaWalker, and, you know, I love people, so I love to hear, you know, thoughts, comments, dreams, new ways of engaging. I think this is a really new, exciting time for artists. I think the model is really shifting. So I'm really open to new kinds of collaborations.
That's great.
So write me, call me. Well, don't call me because I don't like the phone, but email me, tweet me, whatever. You know, I read everything.
That's great. Well, Rebecca Walker, thank you so much for joining us. And I do recommend her books, Black, White, and Jewish: Autobiography of a Shifting Self, and Baby Love, Choosing Motherhood After a Lifetime of Ambivalence. Rebecca Walker, good luck with all your future projects. Keep on writing.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your support, and it's been great to be on the show.
Thank you, Rebecca. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.